Hello, everyone, and welcome to Culturally Relevant. Typically, as we've discussed, this podcast is usually about film, television, art, and culture. But over the past few weeks, obviously, the coronavirus pandemic is on all of our minds, including my own. And so as a result of that, rather than do normally scheduled programming, I am doing kind of this series of diaries where I kind of check in with you all, check in with myself, talk about what's on my mind, talk about what is happening in the world, and hopefully this podcast will serve as kind of a chronicle as to what is going on during these times and kind of a time capsule as to what we're all going through right now. And in order to do that, I am pleased to have my wife joining me again. She is at Joy of Napping on Twitter. I may call her that. Or Joy, how are you doing today?
Well, you know, when life gives you lemons, drag your quarantine partner into the time capsule and force her to record with you.
That's exactly what's happening. What has the last week been like for you, Joy of Napping?
I think in the last week, we have settled more into a rhythm that's true for me at work and at home. And I'm very lucky to be able to work from home. And it's become clear to me that the world is filled with distressing news every day, and I'm going to have to proactively manage what my experience of that is like in order to just stay afloat. Yeah. I think I mentioned to you that there was a night that I got into the shower and I still had some of my clothes on, and I had never done that before in my life. And it just really signaled to me how distracted I am. That I just like sort of can't complete a thought easily. So I'm just extremely gentle with myself. I budget breaks throughout the day. If I'm not very productive, I'm not hard on myself about it. Strangely enough, I've booked some vacation days in which I will just sit in this house and continue to do the same things. But my expectations have just come way down. And then I'm trying to do some other things more that are more in the self-care realm.
All right. Maybe we'll talk about those a little bit later. Yeah. But yeah, I think that's a great attitude to have, which is that it's not your quote unquote responsibility to need to like take in all the sadness and brutality of what's going on at all times. You know, pace yourself, make sure you do self-care. And, you know, the world is still going to be there when you get back, basically. And it's probably not going away for quite a while.
Well, so I'd probably put it slightly differently, which is we have an enormous amount of privilege in that we both work and we have a home we're not going to get evicted from. So given that, you know, it's easy for me to want to focus on all of these other terrible things that are going on because instinctively I'm a little bit of a helper and a worrywart. But if at the end of it, the world is suffering and I have also then taken myself to a non-functional place of suffering, then, you know, the home that we worked very hard for, the jobs we've worked to get, you know, then it wasn't even for anything.
Right.
So I'm trying to both respect our individuality while also recognizing it's a great privilege to have even a little bit of space from this news.
I think that is good perspective. So speaking of news, though, we're about to dive into it. So there's a few things to call out. First of all, as of today, when we're recording this, Thursday, April 2nd, there are now more than 1 million coronavirus cases worldwide. As of Thursday afternoon, at least 50,000 people have died, and the virus has been detected in at least 171 countries. So I think it's just worthwhile to like check in on that and just kind of chronicle what is happening with that, because I feel like it's just, I don't know, for some reason I kind of want to remember what it felt like at this moment. I feel like it'll be valuable later. That's just my instinct.
Well, then what does it feel like to you at this moment?
I think it's interesting because in Washington State, we've started to bend the curve a little bit, and on numerous outlets and publications and newscasts, like Washington State has been held up as like a place that actually has been somewhat successful with its social distancing measures. So like, I'm very encouraged by that. At the same time, there are other places like New York where it seems to be exploding out of control right now. And so it's theoretically going to hit the South really hard over the course of the next couple of weeks. And so it's really being felt differently in different places. I will say that as of a few hours ago, the governor of Washington issued extended the stay-at-home order that is already in place through May 4th. And that really kind of it hit me in a way that I didn't anticipate, because we have like a pretty good routine, and you know, we are getting through each day, working from home, eating food that we have in that we have stored up in the fridge or like non-perishables or whatever. And the stay-at-home order was going to end in a week, basically, right?
In theory,
right? So, but then he extended it by like three to four more weeks, and it just really hit me like, oh, this is the way it's going to be for the foreseeable future. And I know like we had already kind of called that, like we'd already kind of said like, oh, we expect this will continue for a while. But it wasn't until he like issued that directive today that I really felt it on an emotional level.
You kind of holding out hope that you might return sooner, or that we'd flatten the curve enough?
Yeah, that we'd flatten the curve enough that people say like, okay, maybe we can't all just go back to normal, but like, things can be like, some things can be more open. You can go back to work safely, or you can do XYZ safely, or these sets of businesses can be open. Of course I should mention, like, so there are like essential businesses that are open, but, it just really hit me in a way that I didn't anticipate. 'Cause I'm just like, oh, this scenario that we have, we're just going to keep going for the foreseeable future. And again, we are in a place of privilege. We don't have any kids right now, and I know people who have kids are like really struggling because of school and needing to homeschool their kids. So like, I don't want to complain too much or anything. I don't want to come off as I'm complaining, but I'm just like, it just is really like, has started to settle that like, this is what life is going to be for as long as
what are the feelings you have? Is it like sadness? Is it grief? Is it frustration? Is it, I don't think it's excitement.
there's some excitement in there, but you know, really? I think there's a little bit of relief in there, I'll say, because the fact that it is working, the fact that we're going to continue doing it, does make me feel like, oh, people, like the people running this state are responsible enough to get us through this situation. So that does feel good, right? But I don't know, there is this, I don't know if we covered it on last week's podcast, but there is this kind of grieving that a lot of people are doing right now, not just for people who've actually lost loved ones during this time. I read a piece on Vice today about somebody whose cousin died in the last few weeks and how they couldn't be there with their family and how horrifying it was.
That's my nightmare.
Right. And it's just like, that is kind of what has given this virus a really cruel kind of bent, is that like, not only is it killing people, but it's like separating people.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so that's horrifying, obviously. But I think I read a piece about grieving and how, and by the way, I'll link to all these pieces in the show notes, as many of them as I can, but how grieving is, it's okay to grieve because we've lost so many things, from the most important, like the ability to actually grieve the death of loved ones, to the ability to go get a haircut or to go shopping without fearing for your life, or to go to a park and like pet a dog that you pass. You know what I mean? Like all these things that we no longer have. We're experiencing this like huge collective loss. And that's not even talking about the economic losses, which are staggering, right? So maybe this kind of sense of grief that I already had is kind of being amplified a little bit by this news today that we're going to be here through May 4th, at least. So that's why it struck me. Did it strike you at all?
I'm completely unsurprised. It did feel like, oh, this is quite real. And I think the initial announcement of going through early April for stay at home always felt to me like it was just enough to buy us time to get more epidemiology, so then we could decide how much more time we needed. So if we need another month now, that's fine. I fully expect that we could do this for months. I mean, it's grim to imagine, but I think it's very possible.
So I've been doing a lot of reading about the coronavirus, and I think one of the things I've seen shared most often over the course of the last week or so is this piece by Ed Yong over at The Atlantic. I think I saw Barack Obama share this. I think I saw Bill Gates share this. But the title of the article is How the Pandemic Will End. And essentially, this writer, who's a very talented science writer, Ed Yong,
I read this
like
as well,
lays out kind of the different scenarios. And the most likely scenario that he lays out is that, I'm going to read from the article here, quote, "It's likely that the new coronavirus will be a lingering part of American life for at least a year, if not much longer. If the current round of social distancing measures work, the pandemic may ebb enough for things to return to a semblance of normalcy. Offices could fill and bars could bustle. Schools could reopen and friends could reunite. But as the status quo returns, so too will the virus. This doesn't mean that society must be on a continuous lockdown until 2022, but we need to be prepared to do multiple periods of social distancing, says Stephen Kistler of Harvard. Much about the coming years, including the frequency, duration, and timing of social upheavals, depends on two properties of the virus, both of which are currently unknown. And he talks about seasonality is one thing, like whether it will change, the infectiousness will change when we get to summer, which some people think it might. And also the second thing is like duration of immunity. We still don't know, like if you get it, are you immune? Are you immune for a year? Are you immune for 7 days? Like, we don't know. And so this will also like inform what happens. But
I think there's a third thing, which is that it's possible that not everyone is actually susceptible to it. So in areas where it is very dense, like why don't 100% of people on cruise ships get it?
Right.
So it would be incredibly helpful to know if, let's say, some percentage of people just don't get it and like so have effectively a natural immunity and you've already had it. Because a bunch of people can have it asymptomatically.
Yeah.
If you could have an antibody test to show that, then that percentage of people could go out into society
right.
and help us reopen
yes.
things,
yeah,
like, which would be incredibly helpful.
It would also be like this kind of surreal idea of like these people who are like the chosen ones who can like
go out straight out of a science fiction
they
series.
They can go out into society and like help rebuild
yeah,
it.
That
it
they'd have like little wristbands or something that say, I'm safe.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, which by the way, we just saw Contagion and... spoiler for Contagion, the Steven Soderbergh movie, but at the end of that film, they develop a vaccine, which is where this is heading, our situation is heading too. Like one day, at some point in the near or distant future, they will create a vaccine for it, I'm confident. But in Contagion, you get these wristbands if you have the vaccine. And so like that's how people would know whether you could go yeah. out into the world or not. It would be fascinating if like that actually happened in our society. But the thing that really struck me about this article is the idea that like it's not going to be like one day a switch flips and then we go back to normal, right? Like there might be like waves of this thing. Like we might like, okay, hey, maybe let's open the restaurants and like see how it goes. And then, oh, no, another outbreak, like social distancing again goes into play. And like it could be like a start and stop situation, right?
Restaurants will not be as dense. They won't have as many tables packed into them.
They'll probably have different policies too.
Right. And so like then the question is, because restaurants are a very low margin business to start off with, very financially risky, like does going out to restaurants become incredibly expensive?
Right.
Because they have to cover the same amount of rent.
Or do they change their business models? Tom Douglas, who is a celebrity restaurateur in Seattle, there's a piece at Eater today about Tom Douglas, where he basically says, so he had like many, many restaurants open
17.
In Seattle. 17 restaurants open in Seattle. And we have been to many of them and we are big fans of his. And he had apparently a digital all hands on Wednesday night where he said that it's extremely likely that it's going to be tough for 50% of his restaurants to come back. Right. And this is like a really well-known, like well-positioned restaurateur. So like, the restaurant business specifically will look very different when things come back, I think.
The restaurant scene in Seattle overall, as has been noted elsewhere, was actually due for a reckoning. And this just vastly accelerated and made more painful that reckoning.
Yeah, it's very sad. But anyway, that was just one example. But like, you know, restaurants being open or like barbershops being open or hardware stores being open, or I mean, they're already open right now. But you know what I mean? Like there's a scenario where like some things open and then we have like waves of what we're going through right now rather than like... it's over and we can all go back to society as normal, right? That feels like it's in our future.
Yeah,
possibly.
I agree.
Yeah,
I agree.
Speaking of social distancing, I guess one other thing that happened this week that I just want to be sure to mention is that the President of the United States finally started getting real when it comes to...
I don't refer to him by that. I'm not kidding. I refuse to say it.
The President of the United States finally started being realistic about the threat that coronavirus poses to Americans. There was a briefing that he gave in which he and his experts predicted that if we do everything perfectly, if everything goes according to plan, 100 to 240,000 people will die.
In America.
In America. And I just need to reemphasize that fact as much as possible, that like that is a best case scenario, and somehow we're just all willing, like at least 35% of people are still going to vote for the person who oversaw that. You know what I mean? And that is shocking to me that that's true, but I still think we need to, I just want to pause and take a second to say that's terrible that that's the case. And I think many people have pointed out that South Korea and America discovered their cases on the same day, like coronavirus is in their country on the same day. And I think less than 200 people have died in South Korea. Now, of course, South Korea has 1/6 of the population of the U.S., but we have more than 6 times 150 or 160 deaths right now in the United States. And it didn't need to be this way. And that's what's like really the tragedy.
We are at 5x on a per capita basis where South Korea is, and we are just getting warmed up.
Yeah, it's not even over yet. So anyway, it's really sad. Nate Silver today, by the way, said in a tweet, quote, experts in a survey we're publishing say it's somewhere between 70,000 and 1.7 million deaths. Like, that's a better range in terms of what it will end up being. The mean guess is 260,000, but the range is very wide because of a variety of factors, like are we going to maintain social distancing and things of that nature. So whatever the case is, like people have said and pointed out that like this is more people than died in, more Americans than died in World War II and many other of our conflicts that we consider to be major milestones in American history. So it's just kind of staggering to think about. And we're in it now. We're on this path. These are the tram rails that we're on. But I just want to take a second and acknowledge that that's the case and that it's really upsetting. So anyway, in terms of how we will get to the bottom end of that number, social distancing has become a really important thing. And it's also become a thing where it's part of the culture war now, which I think is really sad, that there's this conservative notion of rugged individualism on which this country is founded, that kind of posits that the government should not interfere with our liberties and our ability to go out there and get infected to own the libs. And I think that somebody pointed this out recently too. You know, there have been some church pastors in Florida and other places that have said, I'm going to hold church anyway, and we're an essential business, et cetera, et cetera. We're going to have service. You're a pansy if you don't go to church. Famously, Liberty University, the college that has Jerry Falwell Jr. running it, he invited students back to campus, or at least didn't prohibit it, and now some of them are getting sick. And I remember, like, as a person who grew up in a conservative Christian church, that there is this kind of...
In America,
right? That there is this kind of aspect of conservative Christianity that says that basically, if you are being persecuted, you're basically earning rewards in heaven because you're being persecuted. Like, it is a sign that you're doing the right thing if you're persecuted. And the problem with that is that in America, Christians have basically won in my, like, they are controlling multiple branches of government right now. And so the idea of Christianity being persecuted and also running everything, it's like this cognitive dissonance. Like, how can we be persecuted if we are running everything? And so as a result, I think a lot of Christians try to figure out ways to be persecuted, if that makes any sense. And I don't mean like they're like sitting around and planning it, you know, Rube Goldberg style or anything like that, but I think that like, or like mapping it out. But I think there is this idea of if we're not being persecuted, maybe we're doing something wrong. And so, oh, hey, the government is making us not go to church, or the government is like shutting down our church service. Like, there's something very enticing to a lot of Christians about that. This is like my speculation based on what I've observed in the past. But I do think that separate from that, it has become part of the culture war in a really unfortunate way, that more Democrats think that you should stay home and socially distance than Republicans. And we really shouldn't politicize these kinds of life-saving measures, in my opinion, right?
I don't know that I think it's surprising that the party that believes in collectivism, collective action, public goods, like an economic term about, you know, goods that are not owned individually, but whose benefits are shared, like clean air and clean water, would be the people that are like, hey, we're all in it together. And only as a mass of 360 million people or whatever it is choosing to do the same thing will we get anywhere, versus the party that believes more in not only rugged individualism, but that may the best man win as we slug it out in capitalism. And I chose man intentionally. You know, would have more of a like, well, why don't I just take my fighting chance?
Yeah.
As an individual, there are things about the belief or lack thereof in science that is upsetting. But it's not like science itself isn't cultural, and so I think it's very privileged to think of it as neutral.
That's a fair point. Yeah. They're definitely science in the past has been a tool of cultural imperialism. So
absolutely.
So important to remember, and especially as like the situation is still evolving. Speaking of the science still evolving, one of the most contentious issues right now is whether or not people should be wearing masks. As of right now, the CDC has not yet issued.
But there are all these leaks in the press that they're thinking about it.
So by the time you listen to this podcast, it probably will have changed. But according to the New York Times, the CDC is expected to advise all Americans to wear cloth masks in public. Trump says it will not be mandatory. And this is very controversial for a variety of reasons. And again, Ed Yong, I'll link to an article that he wrote in the show notes, had a great piece about it that you shared with me. The title of the article is in The Atlantic called "Everyone Thinks They're Right About Masks: How the Coronavirus Travels Through the Air Has Become One of the Most Divisive Debates in This Pandemic." And in this article, he kind of examines the evidence for whether or not it is transmissible through the air.
I think that, though, there may be debate about what's effective, what's most effective, etc. But it feels like it nets at it can't hurt, right?
Yeah.
As long as you like wash the thing that is your mask.
I think that's right. There's risk that like if you can't use the mask correctly, like if you don't apply it correctly, you might futz with it and end up actually contaminating yourself even further than if you just didn't have a mask on. Like that is a risk that should be acknowledged. But I think overall you're probably right that it couldn't hurt. The one thing in this piece that I wanted to highlight is you and I have been going out for walks all the time. And in the last week, we've heard so much about how transmissible this thing is.
And just to be clear, I think that the narrative around masks was you as the public do not need a mask, do not take a mask from a medical professional since we have a shortage. But it was never, it will hurt you to have a mask.
Correct.
Other than you'll get the shit beaten out of you for being Asian and wearing a mask, but
we should say that like there's the N95 mask, which is like the mask that can keep out like pathogens of the size of coronavirus, and those are the ones that ideally you are not using those because those should be going to our medical workers. But if you fashion a DIY cloth mask, it probably couldn't hurt. Probably couldn't hurt, right? But anyway, we've been going on walks, and one thing that you had sent me was this article at Huffington Post entitled "8 Things People Diagnosed with Coronavirus Want You to Know." And one of those things is it spreads like wildfire, according to this article. Trevor Mankin, a Lutheran pastor in Seattle who's had COVID-19, was alarmed at how easily the virus spreads. On March 1st, Mankin visited a friend in the hospital who he later found out has COVID-19. Though he had taken all the right safety precautions, he wore a gown and a face mask and washed his hands thoroughly. Both Mankin and his wife felt run down just a few days later and tested positive before the novel coronavirus on the 11th. Before his symptoms really kicked in, Mankin stopped by his office to pick up some files. The next day, his secretary went to work. Though he had no contact with her, other than touching the doorknob or him coughing in a room she later entered, she got COVID-19. It can spread so easily, Mankin said. It doesn't seem to matter if you're in contact with a person or not, end quote. So there's an article about the Skagit Valley coral where like...
Which will be studied by epidemiologists for 10 years.
Yeah.
It's this like, one coral practice.
It was what, 60 people went to a chorus practice. They tried to stay apart from each other. They used like sanitizer, everything like that. 45 of them got sick. As of right now, a couple of them have died. And so I'm saying all these things not to fearmonger, but to say that I think there's still a lot of disagreement about how transmissible it actually is, and the methods by which it can be transmissible. And so we had heard for a long time, it's droplets. It's something that you touch like on a doorknob or something, and then you touch your mouth and that's it. But people are saying, if we all wear masks, we can prevent ourselves from expelling droplets into the air. We can prevent maybe some droplets from coming into contact with us. And
you know, I know you basically had a horrified reaction to this, but I always thought, what's the difference between a droplet and something that can float on the air for several feet or circulate for 5 minutes? And so I wasn't as surprised.
Yeah.
It's the reason that if I buy a box of crackers at the grocery store, I will touch that box only with gloves. I will bring it in the house and I will leave it in the corner for 4 days before I touch it again, because I'm, you know, not about that life. but I think there is just intellectual trigger that comes for people with the word airborne.
Yeah.
And I would just tell you, I think there's a huge range in there, and you should just assume that while a person coughing six houses away is not going to spread it to us on the wind and have it come in through our air ventilation system, that you should treat it as if everything is contaminated all the time.
So when we go outside, and to be clear, this article says, hey, when you go outside, the risk is extremely low to get
because
it
because of fresh air and wind.
Because of ventilation and everything like that. But the one piece of advice that I thought was really great in this article, again, it will be in the show notes, is, quote, you could tie yourself in knots gaming out the various scenarios that might pose a risk, but one of the experts in the article recommends a simple technique. Quote, when I go out now, I imagine everyone is smoking, and I pick my path to get the least exposure to that smoke. And then the author asks, if that's the case, is it irrational to hold your breath when another person walks past you and you don't have enough space to move away? Quote, it's not irrational. I do that myself. I don't know if it makes a difference, but in theory, it could. It's like when you walk through a cigarette plume, end quote. And so we've generally been doing a good job of socially distancing when we go out into the world, but that's kind of how I imagine when I see people now. I imagine this kind of smoke plume around them, and I'm just like, gotta get away from that smoke plume.
We host host is a strong word, but we, you know, have a daily little Periscope chit chat with the world, and someone suggested that we should Google a YouTube video for slow motion sneeze.
Yeah.
And I just picture everybody as like Pigpen, you know, from Peanuts, just a cloud of dust and soot around them. And I am trying not only to not walk through the cloud, but also to not walk through the cloud where the cloud just was.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, again, to be clear, you know, it's extremely unlikely you would get it out in the world, but I think we are just both really cautious people.
I buy groceries for my 70-year-old parents once a week, one of whom has respiratory issues and the other of whom is diabetic. I can take my risk from very low to basically zero. I will be doing that.
Yeah. Okay. So that's a lot of the stuff that's been going on around the world with coronavirus, and kind of in the last few weeks, as we've been doing this coronavirus diary, we've been doing this kind of check-in on the Asian Americans in the world, because Asian American harassment and violence continues to tear through the society, because it's not as though we have enough things to contend with. We also must deal with the racism inherent in the system. Today, Andrew Yang published an article in the Washington Post that...
Asians don't have a corollary for the cookout, but if we did, Andrew Yang would be disinvited from the cookout.
The title of the article is Andrew Yang, We Asian Americans Are Not the Virus, But We Can Be Part of the Cure. This is one of the worst things I've read.
You remember Andrew Yang.
Possibly ever.
The one who had some really interesting policy ideas,
yeah,
but also campaigned on Asians being good at math.
He didn't campaign on that, but that was
part of... He had a hat that said math.
So here is a quote from the article. "We Asian Americans need to embrace and show our Americanness in ways we never have before. We need to step up, help our neighbors, donate gear, vote and wear red, white, and blue, volunteer, fund aid organizations, and do everything in our power to accelerate the end of the crisis. We should show without a shadow of a doubt that we are Americans who will do our part for our country in this time of need," end quote. Now, there's nothing inherently wrong with anything that he just said. Like, all those things, like, there's nothing wrong with doing any of those things. The problem with the article is the framing of that request, right? It's that, like...
I actually have a problem with that request. Yeah, I mean when you say, what, we have to wear red, white, and blue to prove that we're American?
Yeah, I mean...
Fuck that noise.
I think that the idea that, like, we need to demonstrate our... There's so many problems with this article. One is that... we need to somehow, like, demonstrate our Americanness, which is just a notion on its face that I reject because I think it's super backwards. But number two, the idea that, like, once we demonstrate it, that somehow this harassment will stop. It's not going to stop. This is not the solution. The solution is not Asian Americans need to be better. The solution is we need to call out this racism and stomp it out in whatever socially acceptable ways we can do that in as much as we can. And so I'm really bothered by this thing. It disgusts me. I'm very upset by this article. Your thoughts?
Well, first of all, this evening I saw a tweet from Melissa Hung, who is a Asian American writer for NPR, among other places. And she tweeted was, "I've never seen Asian American Twitter so united, LOL." And subtweet received, "Melissa Hung, I know exactly what you're talking about," which is every Steven Yeun like lit this thing up. Like, everybody is upset about it.
Andrew Yang's record as an Asian American candidate was mixed, because on the one hand, it was kind of inspiring to see an Asian American dude get that far in the Democratic primary, right? Or the Democratic process. Is it primary?
Primary.
Yeah. On the one hand, it was a great thing to see.
Primaries were these things that happened long ago where people got real close to each other in line for hours in order to mark things on pieces of paper that they would then hand with their filthy hands over to somebody else who wasn't wearing gloves. And then maybe they'd like coffee on each other on the way out. But it's BC, before coronavirus.
So it was inspiring to see that. And I think UBI, Universal Basic Income, is an idea that certainly in today's day does have a lot of resonance, right? But then he would say really dumb ass shit about Asians, and that really pissed me off. You know, I think he would joke around with it, and it's like, okay, whatever. I can. The whole time, my attitude was, okay, you're figuring this out. You're figuring this out. You want to come across as likable. You don't want to complain too much about anti-Asian discrimination. That's all good. Fine. Then he goes and he writes this piece, and now all my goodwill is
gone. That piece is written from deep in the sunken place. Like, that man's brain has been colonized. There is a white person speaking from the middle of that person's brain.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, number one, I am American. I don't have to literally wear red, white, and blue.
The wear red and blue part was kind of dumb.
You know, and then the idea that helping our neighbors, donating, volunteering, funding aid organizations is somehow more American, and where we are is we're less American. Like, first of all, I did all those things, you know, very proactively. And secondly, other countries do that as well. And thirdly, this essentially says you should blend in and you should un-Asian yourself. Like, that's the implication, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And rather than saying America is a place that has lots of different modes of being American, and that is the point, is the diversity here, and that what is an American has many forms of expression and express yourself in all those ways. You know, I think it basically is like, it feels a little bit like some, you know, I can't can't. Okay. We're going to have to cut that.
No, we don't. I think I just want to, catching you trailing off, because we're at a loss for words. It is...
Just, if you've ever seen somebody who's in a toxic relationship, but they think their abuser is going to change their ways...
Yes.
That is exactly how he sounds.
It's a perfect example. It's a perfect example. And
if I just didn't wear such provocative clothing, then he wouldn't be mad at me when I go out.
Right. Provocative clothing that doesn't have red, white, and blue on it.
If my SAT scores were just a little higher.
So to obviously very infuriating article, and I denounce it thoroughly. I do just want to highlight that, like, the Asian American harassment continues unabated. Aro Kwan, best-selling author who is a friend of the podcast, who's been a former guest on this show. I'd recommend you listen to that episode if you can. Tweeted.
New York Times.
Yeah.
Best-selling author.
Tweeted last night. Last night, I was part of an otherwise lovely Zoom panel with writers I admire. Two of us are Asian American, one Korean and one Sri Lankan. And a racist troll or two crashed our event. And then she tweets out a screenshot. And I'll just read one of these things. She says, somebody said, "Hey, Chinese bitch, stop eating bats." Aro Kwan then continues in this tweet thread. "I kept thinking of the in-law recently who, when I mentioned the surge in anti-Asian racism, drew on right-wing and also very racist rhetoric by doubting the racism, saying, 'Is that really happening, though?' And I mean, I was called a Chinese bitch. I will live. I will get past this. The 2-year-old and 6-year-old who were stabbed in Texas by a racist man who attacked them because he thought they were Chinese, though, they will have a harder time getting past this." And then she references this article for this terrible event that happened in Texas. "Even the orange clown has acknowledged that without action, this virus could kill over 2 million Americans. 1.5 million American combatants have been killed in all U.S. wars. It's hard not to imagine what's to come and who will be considered the enemy. Even the way I just said, 'I'll live, I'll get past this,' I'm noticing I'm brushing away how it felt. This Zoom panel was the first time I've done anything in public, quote unquote, in a month. So the first time I did anything public, and voila, racism. So let me not brush it away. I cried after the panel, thinking about how shitty and shaky so many of my Asian friends feel, and how shitty I felt, too. I cried thinking of how this rise in anti-Asian racism is possibly just getting started." And she goes on a little bit longer, but that is something that really illuminated to me that the possibility that, like, how bad this might get, you know? And I don't think we know yet, because... if it does in fact kill millions of Americans, I think we'll continue to see these racist incidents rise. And I'm scared of the rage that might come from that. Do you have any thoughts?
I have two thoughts. One's positive and one is... So I'd like to get to the second thought in a minute, which is about China and, like, the Chinese government's role. But I will say on a positive note that this week, I'd say every couple weeks, my company, which has, I should probably know the answer to this, maybe between 5 and 10,000 employees in North America. So not like a huge company, but not small, had a virtual town hall. And the chairman for North America gave some general updates and, you know, about the business. And it's actually really funny. He did it from his daughter's bedroom. And since she has left for, I don't know, it hasn't been touched since she was in the third grade. It had like teddy bears and like a heart-shaped mirror on the wall. It was actually quite endearing because people are having to take conference calls from all sorts of random parts of their houses. But, He took a moment and said, "I just want to note that a number of our Asian colleagues are reporting that they feel very uncomfortable because of the anti-Asian sentiment that is out there in America." And I don't think it was like in our work setting. I haven't heard about that at all. But it was really heartening to hear somebody that senior say something so early, and that, you know, we needed to, of course, A, that it's unacceptable, but B, that we need to like look out for each other. And so I did appreciate that.
It's been an Amazon guidance as well. So that's been nice to see.
Because normally I just feel like our issues just don't get taken seriously, or they get minimized, or they...
Asian American issues specifically.
Yeah, that it's like, oh, that can't be that bad, right? Or like surely just a handful of situations, like, you know... I think there's just a desire to hope that it isn't that big of a deal.
Yeah.
And so I did feel taken very seriously. And I used that opportunity then to Slack a few different people I know to say like, oh, did you just hear that? Like, I can't believe he said that. And the people I were Slacking to, none of them were Asian, but it felt like it gave me space to then talk about it and bring up that it's on my mind. And so they had all read about it, which was good. But then I think they hadn't necessarily, like, no one's come to me and asked me, how do you feel as an Asian person? And so I feel really grateful that I had the space to do that. As far as where this could go, in the last day or two, as these numbers have been released that are so high that there are potential death forecasts, and the new unemployment figures have come out, and those are also just staggering. I think people are looking for somebody to blame who is not us. And where that tends to go is, well, the Chinese government underreported their statistics. And my reaction to this is, no fucking shit. Like, this is not a regime that's no, like, I never looked at their statistics and took great comfort in them in the first place. But what I did notice is that they shut down an entire province and they were practically ready to let all those people die. Right? Like, there were no supply trucks going in a good way. Like, there was, I really thought it was possible that out of what it was at 50 million people-ish in Wuhan, that like half of them could die and it would be like a genocide or like a Holocaust level like event. And fortunately, that's not what happened. But I assumed that this government, the Chinese government, maybe they were slow to act and maybe they minimize the problem internally along the way, but that when they saw how infectious it was, they brought in like the biggest hammers they had, and those were pretty terrifying to watch go into effect. And so I saw that and I thought, that thing is coming for us. I don't know if it's going to kill 50,000 people or 1 million people, and obviously there's a huge difference, but I never didn't take it seriously. And so the idea that if they had simply reported higher numbers, then like the rest of the world would have taken it more seriously, I just don't buy that as like a scapegoating. And then what we saw in Italy or Iran, like I just don't buy that we simply didn't have enough information from the Chinese Communist Party. And that's why we're in the situation that we're in, where America is sucking worse than everybody else, basically. Like, it is our own fault. I don't know like how hard it is to simply accept that you screwed up, but
I'm going to go out on a limb and say really hard.
Yeah.
Really hard.
Right? And so when people talk about American exceptionalism, one of the things that I think is exceptional is the belief that we are somehow better than other people when very basic evidence shows us otherwise.
Yeah. And in the first of these coronavirus diaries, I kind of discussed how I felt like America is the world, you know, some people have called it like the richest third world country in the world, or it's acting like a rich failed state, essentially. And I think there's a lot of that idea has only become strengthened in the weeks, for me, at least in the weeks since this has all started. So let's take a quick break from our normally scheduled discussions to, first of all, if you're enjoying listening to this podcast, I've been getting...
It's such a light listen.
It's such a light, such a breezy listen, you know? feel free to email us at culturallyrelevantshow@gmail.com. I've gotten a lot of emails from people in the last couple weeks saying they really appreciate these, and so that's why I've continued doing them. But yeah, culturallyrelevantshow@gmail.com. You can also follow the show on Twitter at CrevShow. That's CrevShow. And if you could share about us or leave a review on Apple Podcasts, it would really help this podcast out. Let's close on a more lighter note.
Well, I have a question for you. How much longer do you think you'll be doing this as opposed to other more traditional episodes of Culturally Relevant?
I think probably one or two more of these, and then going back to regularly scheduled program. And there is a very exciting guest I'm interviewing next week. And
yeah.
I feel like I gotta I have to put that episode out in the foreseeable future, because it's also, by the way, quite relevant to our conversations. So, but I will not reveal who that is, but suffice to say, I'm thinking, you know, a few more weeks and hopefully.
And then it's all going to be like homemade brioche and like how I spent my quarantine vacation.
Hopefully. I don't know. I guess I want to keep talking about this as long as it feels like something that people care about and that I care about. And then, you know, we'll see how it goes from there. But eventually I will probably want to go back to reviewing movies and having, you know, interesting guests on the show. I just don't know exactly when that's going to be, but hopefully in the next few weeks, as opposed to the next few months. That's kind of how I feel about it. I will say this, though. I do think that the idea of me doing these monologues or these dialogues...
Yeah, monologue. Way harsh.
No, I mean, well, there's that one episode that you weren't on, but I do think I want to try to continue that somehow in some form. And that's what's great about doing my own podcasts. We can do whatever we want, you know? So anyway, that's kind of a cop-out answer, but there you go. Okay. So let's end on a lighter note. And let's talk about some of the things that have been helping us to get through this challenging time, right? So is there any media you've been consuming, any habits you've been forming, anything like that that has been helping you?
Well, I think it's funny that you asked, is there any media you've been consuming that's been helping you? Because the answer is definitely no. All the media I'm consuming is not helping me because I read the news all the time. And I find myself a little too brain dead to really watch a movie or a TV show and disengage. I think that's your go-to.
It's been challenging for me as well, but yeah.
I suspect you have more in that realm than I do.
But anything else that's been helping you during this time?
So actually it's exercise. Mm-hmm. I would say I took a run the other day for the first time in quite a while, for a variety of reasons. I'm wildly out of shape. And, that was not a great experience. But it was a great post experience in that I, felt much less sad. It's not like I felt happy. Just the depth of sadness was shallower. So that's great. And we have a little exercise bike. It's kind of janky, but between that and running, I think that's actually really good. I don't have the emotional fortitude right now to do yoga, where people are like, you know, and just concentrate on your breath. And like, that actually makes me feel more frantic, but there's something about like physically moving. I've always loved running because I am terrible at it. And it takes all my concentration to just keep going. I'm not very fast. I'm sure my form isn't great. But that is exactly what I'm looking for right now, is something that's like so occupying that it basically crowds out all other things. And because right now it is spring, it's really beautiful and heartening to see little flowers in bloom. You know, even if the pandemic takes us all, those flowers are still going to bloom next year. So
it's pretty surreal, this crisis we're going through, you know, because it's all these juxtapositions that are really confusing to witness. On the one hand, we have this statewide lockdown quarantine situation going on, but also... it's sunny outside. It's not like nuclear winter or anything like that. It's beautiful in Seattle
these
days.
Nothing looks wrong.
Nothing looks wrong. There's birds singing and everything like that. We have no shortage of food in terms of our supply chain. And everyone has filtered water coming out of their sink still. You know, like everything feels like it's okay if you go outside, but really it hides this upsetting reality that's been kind of surreal to experience. So...
The other thing that has helped me is I was feeling rather sad that my birthday is coming up and I will definitely be in quarantine for it. And I'm not a birthday person. And as time goes by, that is more and more and more people's birthdays that will get celebrated inside. So there's nothing special about my, you know, isolation. But I think it really felt like one of those times where I really felt how enforced the distance is. You can't even break it a little bit. I can't go see my parents as much as I would like to. And Anyway, so in preparation for that, because I did not want to eat sad quarantine ramen or whatever we'll be on at that point in terms of our pantry, I bought a little cake and I read about how to freeze the cake and I bought a little mini champagne and I bought frozen fancy hors d'oeuvres. Those are never as delicious as you want them to be. And they're always like the most expensive thing in the frozen section.
Yeah.
But I got a couple of those. So we'll see if they're good or not. They're probably mediocre at best. But I just wanted the day to feel a little special. And the ways that things can feel special right now, there just aren't that many available to us. I could make a cake. But trust me, my cake is not going to be as good as like a professional baker's cake.
I'm just going to say at Joy of Napping that there might be a surprise or two on your birthday. So just wait and see. Do not lose hope yet.
I'm already really excited for what I know is coming.
Yeah.
Because we talked about, would we want to have a virtual party or something like that? And I said what I really wanted was to talk to my two best friends in like a Google Hangout or a Zoom or something. And so you very kindly arranged that for me. And that really means a lot to me. I'm super stoked for it.
All right. Well, I'm glad to hear that. And I know this, we're all just adjusting to what life is going to be like under these new conditions. So birthdays apart will be a thing.
Did you hire like a Baby Yoda stripper for me?
No comment.
Are you going to get a little hat for the stair mushroom?
Little
birthday hat.
I'll just talk about a few quick things. I was watching this movie called The Platform tonight on Netflix, which is pretty on the nose for what society is. Have you heard of The Platform by any chance? It's this movie that people have been talking about.
I heard about it when I walked through the living room earlier and I said, what are you watching?
The idea is that you wake up in this
platform.
You wake up in this room, and in the middle of the room.
Wait, what did you say?
One wakes up in this room, and there's like.
How do you pronounce that word?
Room.
Okay.
Is there something wrong with the way I pronounce room?
You pronounce it sort of room as opposed to room.
Anyway, the characters wake up in this room. And
you did it again.
There is this huge hole in the middle of it, and you look down it, and it's like an elevator shaft. And there's like think of it like hundreds of floors underneath you that also have two people. You are with a roommate. It's you and a roommate, and hundreds of floors underneath you that also have people, right? And then hundreds of floors above. And every day at a specific time, a platform is lowered down that has food on it, but it's only the leftovers of what everyone in the floors above you has eaten, right? And it's pretty on the nose metaphor about society. Just gonna put that out there. So
what's the point?
Well, I think it's just it's a way of making many things that we experience in our society hyper literal. Right, like there's another good example of this that I can think of is Darren Aronofsky's Mother, you know, the movie starring
the one I refuse to watch.
Yeah, which when I saw that movie the first time, I really did not enjoy it because I thought, "Wow, way too obvious." But then as time has gone on, I have come to appreciate the audacity.
You actually now love it, right?
I actually really quite like that movie now. But it's making Mother Nature right into a literal character. And what happens if we were to actually harvest that person and take everything from her that we, you know, wanted, which is what we do with nature today, and how terrible would that be if it was a person, you know? And so I do think there is some utility in illustrating these abstract concepts in a super literal way.
Well, but I think what I'm asking is, like, what's the utility? Because it feels like you could literally sketch a diagram, and then, like, why is this a two-hour movie?
Why is it a two-hour movie? Well, because sometimes...
Is it like in Snowpiercer, where the people at the bottom revolt, and then they...
Well, I'm not going to go into spoilers or anything. I've already given away the premise, but suffice to say that the characters encounter some interesting challenges. So I was also... It reminded me also of Vincenzo Natali's horror film, Cube, which...
Do you mean Cube?
It reminded me of Vincenzo Natali's movie Cube, which takes place all in one location. Like, the set is just one room. So, Anyway, so that's The Platform. It's on Netflix, something I've been watching. I've been playing video games quite a bit, and that's been something that's helped me get through this, specifically Doom Eternal and Ori and the Will of the Wisp. I've played on Xbox.
I think you beat both of those,
Both of those games. I talked about them on Jeff Cannata's DLC podcast. That was a lot of fun. That's really helped me get my mind off things, is to play video games. And I think I might have talked about it on a previous episode of how it helps to have like a goal immediately in front of you. Like, take the key and put it into the thing, you know, bring it from one location to the next, because we're living in such uncertain times that the certainty of a video game is oddly comforting, even if you are fighting through the depths of hell as you are in the game Doom Eternal. So those are things I've been helping to keep my head on straight and keep me a little bit centered, is playing video games and watching movies that are a sad metaphor for our society. but a few of the things that have been some comfort during this time. I will also say that a lot of my efforts have been focused on, before this whole thing began, about 7 weeks ago, if you can imagine such a time frame, I started a journey to start losing weight. I started calorie counting. And again, I know people are going through unimaginable trials right now, so this is not me complaining or saying my challenges are particularly big in the grand scheme of things, but I'm just reflecting on the fact that it is very challenging to try to calorie count in a time, like what I have heard very often from people I follow online and from friends, is that during this pandemic, people have been stress eating going back to old habits and like taking a lot of comfort in food, which is something I used to do all the time. You know, food used to be such a comfort for me, and you eat that cookie or you have that slice of pie and it feels great and you forget about your problems for a second. And I have not been doing that at all. And it has, or I've been doing it significantly, Adjo of Napping reacted very poorly to that. I've been doing it.
I can't tell you that I don't find a half empty mini Pringles can every day of a different flavor somewhere else in this living room, or ice cream sandwich wrappers, or ice cream bar wrappers, or my favorite, which is the ice cream sandwich with a bite taken out of it, but not really rewrapped and just thrown back in the freezer.
So, well, that's one of the great things about calorie counting, is that you can still eat the foods you like and still lose weight, theoretically. I will say this. I'm eating those things at far lower quantity than I would be eating if I wasn't calorie counting.
So right? Actually, if you weren't calorie counting, you probably would have like gained 20 pounds, but instead you've lost
Or at least like maintained my previous weight. But I've lost 10 pounds in the last 7 weeks.
Wow. High five.
Yep.
You look so good. I'm so proud of you.
It's just been, it's been tough to maintain, because every day I just feel like, man, I feel like my life would be better if I just stress ate everything, you know, around the house. And it's kind of a daily battle to not do that. Again, I know people are fighting much more challenging battles today. So my problems are 0.00001% of the difficulty that other people are encountering.
Well, so what do you do when you have that feeling? Like, how do you not succumb to it?
I think it helps to have like a routine around, I'm using an app called My Net Diary, and you enter in everything you eat. And I've gotten so into the habit of entering in everything I eat that it's very difficult for me now to not enter in things if I eat them, right? Because it's basically cheating to not enter it in.
But right? Like, let's say you had a slice of pie, which is a moot, you know, it's a fantasy because we don't have any pie in this house, nor are we going to go to the effort to make one. But let's say you had a 600 calorie slice of pie. You could just put that into My Net Diary. It would just replace a meal.
Correct.
And so then what keeps you from doing that?
Because essentially what I've learned during this process is that different foods have vastly different amounts of calories in terms of the weight to calorie ratio. So I will say, and I'm probably going to make a video about this, I'm hoping when I get to like 20 or 30 pounds lost, that will be enough of a difference that I feel like, okay, like I've been doing this for long enough that I actually feel like I can give useful advice on this. So I don't have useful advice yet, but here's some things I've learned, in my opinion, that have helped me, is there's some things that we have a food scale now, so I weigh everything I eat. And there's some things when I weigh them, and I'm always, when I enter it into the app, I'm always pleasantly surprised at how few calories they are.
Like
what? The number one thing.
Fresh strawberries.
Fresh strawberries.
Yeah.
It's just, I freaking heap those things onto the plate, and I'm always like, I always like get a little like smile in my face when I like enter in like 300 grams of strawberries, and it's like 125 calories. And I'm just like, oh my gosh, I can eat so many strawberries, and like it's such a small calorie gain, you know? And then you eat, you know, a tiny slice of cheesecake, and it's like the same number of calories, and it, you feel way less full afterwards.
Yeah.
Right. And so that's the problem, is you can enter in, yes, I could eat a pie, but then I know I would feel hungry at the end of the day. So it's like, that is the sacrifice one makes when one is fumbling through this situation as I am, is yes, you can do that. You can eat the thing, but then you know you're going to have a bad rest of the day.
You know what's amazing is basically, I think what you have done is you have taken what used to be a positive sort of neural pathway of like, you eat the sugar, it's delicious, and then it hits your pleasure centers, and then, you know, it's like, green light, keep doing that. And you've added a new stop on the neural pathway, which has completely rerouted it. And now you have a different sort of pleasure, which is like, wow, I get to eat all these strawberries.
Yeah.
So it's awesome.
But that's also, it's also difficult, the fact that we at this point do not go regularly to the supermarket, because we consider it to be risky to do so, right? It's not like you have a huge percentage chance of getting it, but it's more than 0%. You know, that if you go to the grocery store, you will accidentally touch something or brush past something and then accidentally touch yourself or whatever. And so before this lockdown began, I could just mosey on down to the store.
I feel like we went to the grocery store 4 times a week.
Yeah. Just mosey on down, and all the strawberries and the fruits you want, whatever I need to make it through, and I could experiment and whatever. And now I can't do that anymore, right? Because we are trying to limit our trips. And so, I've said this multiple times, very small challenge in the big scheme of things, but that is something that I've been struggling with over the last...
It's not necessarily a big challenge, but it's a challenge you have to think about all day long. When you have to lose weight, one of the things that's really hard, I think, is that it's... Not to say that quitting alcohol is easy, but you don't need alcohol to live. You must eat in order to live. So then you have to make different choices than what you're used to. You're faced with that choice all over, like every day, 6 times a day, probably.
Right. So, and you know, I know that people out there are encountering their own disruptions to their routines that are very, very challenging. And so I hope that wherever you are, whatever you're doing, that you are finding habits that help help you keep centered during this time. I'll close this article that I read today at NPR. Did you see this piece? I think I emailed it to you about this guy who is essentially has been living by himself for 50 years. The article is entitled... here we go. I'm pulling it up right now. Tips from someone who with nearly 50 years of social distancing experience.
Okay, I'm going to be honest. You sent me that at like 4 a.m. because you couldn't sleep.
Yes.
And then when I woke up and I saw that, I was like, I don't want to take advice from someone who spent 50 years social distancing. So I gave that a pretty light skim.
I'm not going to go through every single piece of advice, but there are three pieces of advice on here that are pretty good. Piece of advice number one, keep track of something. One of the big challenges that we have right now is like all the days blend into one. Weekends and weekdays are indistinguishable from each other because we're staying, I'm working less on the weekends, but we're not going to the office or anything like that. We're not seeing friends on the weekends like we usually would. And so this guy is suggesting, his name, by the way, is Billy Barr, who has been the only full-time resident of Gothic, Colorado for 50 years. And he's saying, keep track of something. And he's talking about, like, the weather, you know?
This is a guy who retreats to, like, an abandoned mine with, like, a winter's worth of food at a time.
Correct. That's right. In the era of COVID-19, he's just tracking what you can or can't find at the grocery store, or participate in a citizen science experiment. Like there's some experiments where you can keep track of rainfall across the country. He says, you know, get a little rain gauge, put it outside. You're part of a network of other people, thousands of people that are doing something to further the cause of humanity. And that's something that people enjoy. Second thing he says, keep a routine. You know, every day, get on the same routine, follow the same time schedule. And he says, most importantly, leave a reward at the end of the day. He will knit, read, watch a movie, maybe watch a game of cricket. So that's a thing that he suggests, keep a routine. And then also he says, this one is interesting. Celebrate the stuff that matters rather than the stuff you're supposed to celebrate. So because he doesn't have... holidays are meaningless to this person, and he doesn't interact with anyone. So like birthdays, he doesn't celebrate, or he interacts with people, but like not very often. So he doesn't celebrate birthdays that much. He says he does celebrate January 17th when sunrise goes back to what it was in the solstice. To me, that's a big deal because I get up so early in the morning that the lighter it gets, the earlier it makes my day a lot easier, end quote. So anyway, I thought that was an interesting thing. It reminds me of something Stephen Tobolowsky said, which is as you get older, you start celebrating anniversaries rather than birthdays. Like anniversaries become more important than birthdays. They both represent the same amount of time around the sun, but one is a function of determination and the other one is a function of luck. And that stuck with me. By the way, you can listen to that at thetobolowskifiles.com. Anyway, you were about to say something at Joy of Napping.
Well, I just feel, unfortunately, I guess I'm on team... mind man. But you know, we'll frequently be
Billy Barr, by the way,
so team Billy Barr, taking a little, you know, constitutional in the neighborhood.
We'll be walking around the neighborhood. Yeah,
a constitutional is a fair synonym for walking around the neighborhood.
I'm just letting people know who don't know that.
And I will frequently stop and exclaim, oh my god, look at that cherry blossom tree, just look at it. Look at it, how beautiful it is today, or how it's swaying in the wind. I took 3 videos the other day of just cherry blossom trees swaying in the wind because it's such an ephemeral season, cherry blossom, you know, when they're really in full bloom. They're just so magical. And I'm looking really closely at them and I'm like, look at how the petals like are white in the middle and they fade to pink at the edges. And you are always just like, lady, just come on and keep walking, okay? Like, and I wish you could help me celebrate the things that matter as opposed to the things that we are supposed to celebrate.
Well, I think the reason I react that way is not because I don't want to stop and literally smell the roses with you. It's because I am nervous about being outside. You know, I want to minimize my time being outside because I think if, I don't know. I'm just nervous because, you know, of the stuff we've talked about on this podcast.
We've already talked about how I'm incredibly angry about racism and other injustice. So I am primed to fight if anyone wants to come and interrupt my cherry blossom time that I feel I have earned. Also, I think the point is like to have a little circuit breaker on that loop of sort of anxiety and intensity that we get by being on our devices all day and fed like breaking news updates that are 100% bad. By just, you know, admiring the tree a little bit or admiring the flower. There is a particularly delightful little flower thing that is green and pale green that is growing all over our street. And I have no one to ask about it because no one's in their yards. But I love that thing. And every time I see it, I, you know, just get filled with delight. And so I just want to experience a little delight. And if you, you know, maybe we should walk separately from now on. What do you think?
I'll try to be there in the moment with you. When you do that from now on.
Okay. And if I see anybody coming with a knife and yelling slurs, I will also try to break off my time with nature and yell at them more quickly.
All right. Sounds like a plan. Well, I hope you've enjoyed this episode of the podcast. This episode was powered by Simplecast. Simplecast.com is where you can go if you want to find a great tool for podcast management and analytics. Find more episodes of this podcast at culturallyrelevantshow.com. You can also email us at culturallyrelevantshow@gmail.com. I'll try to read some emails in the next episode or two. I really appreciate those emails coming in to culturallyrelevantshow@gmail.com. And follow us on Twitter at CrevShow. That's CrevShow. If you want to follow my wife, you can find her on Twitter at Joy of Napping. And find me on Twitter at Dave Chensky. That's Dave Chen, S-K-Y. Joy of Napping, thanks for joining me today.
I had very little choice, but you're welcome.